Good afternoon, Tom Haines and Mac McClellan from the aviation journalism world are here, and we're also joined by Afterburner Al, also known as Fareed Gyo, who's the director of e-publications for EAA now.
Manager.
Sorry, I just demoted you by accident. Okay, manager of e-publications. Okay.
How about VP?
VP, no. It's a director is above me. Mary Jones is director of publications. But we won't get it. We won't quibble over titles. Okay. We all just like to write about aviation.
She might, yes.
So, Mac, you were talking about a bifurcation in the marketplace, for about the lack of a better word, of pilots, those who go for transportation and those who go for sport. So does this split in the pilot community roughly align with the difference between people who are licensed as private pilots and those who might be or pursue sport pilot license?
I think it's a beginning. With success, we can grow the light sport and sport pilot into something that's more effective. What needs to be done is to build a track record of equivalent safety, where the light sport or the sport pilot is not learning things that he doesn't need, because he's going to fly on a sunny day away from crowded airspace, could add on certain endorsements as needed. So it reduces the complexity. And if after a few years this group demonstrates to the FAA and to the world that they're doing every bit as well in the safety sense as the private pilot, then that gives the FAA the evidence it needs to expand the sport range, the light sport, to something that would include most of the classics. It's silly that a Cessna 150 is a couple hundred pounds heavier, so it doesn't fit. Many of the antique airplanes that we all want to see preserved and there's great interest in owning and restoring, they could be included. As soon as the FAA establishes and can point to, we changed, but nothing bad happened. And it's the same with the medical. Perhaps private, in the future, the medical may go away. When the equivalent safety is established through the sport pilot.
How much longer will this take, or what events would occur so that we know this isn't in fact happened?
I think it's probably needs like a 10-year period. I think a 10-year period would be a nice round number that the industry and the FAA could point to. And what the FAA really needs is cover for the public, or from the public, if that's the right way to put it. So they can say, we did not make this any less safe. We found unnecessary restrictions, and now we've just like the Paperwork Reduction Act, which of course didn't reduce paperwork, but it would be the same concept. We've regulated less.
Tom, from the AOPA community, is there maybe a relaxing of the bias against light sport training or the skill level that's attained by a light sport pilot? I have sensed for a few years that there was a sort of a, if not bias, maybe a high level of concern about it.
Yeah, there certainly was. We certainly sensed with our membership when the light sports first came out and first began being introduced that there were people who believed that that was the wrong way to go, that fewer controls and less training was not the right thing. But it's been interesting over the last year, I think, as light sports have gotten more attention, kind of a bit of a foothold in the marketplace. And maybe it's because, as I said earlier, our sweepstakes airplane is Remus GX this year. So we have been more engaged in the light sport market over the last year. But what I've seen is that more acceptance, that people finally are starting to get it, that these can operate in a different environment. They're used for different things. And that people who want to get a sport pilot certificate, or people who have a private pilot certificate who want to fly as a sport pilot, should be able to do so in these light airplanes, and that you don't have to over-regulate, and it can be done more simply with the restrictions that come with it, and maybe there's opportunity to change that going forward. But I think it is starting to get some traction. People are starting to understand what a light sport is for.
I think the structure kind of legitimizes the whole attempt at putting together a entry level rating. And it may not be perfect, but the structure is in place and people are slowly accepting it. So I guess I would agree with Mac's 10-year period kind of thing, where we're going to need a certain amount of time to look at how this implements itself naturally, and that everybody, that the system that's put forward and the philosophy put forward, that if we make it affordable and accessible and and we just focus on basic pilot skills and then allowing them to go out, enjoy aviation, and also get better without all the, not necessarily onerous, but I guess kind of added stuff that a lot of people may not be interested in, like the cross countries, like some of the other things that you do and later in a private pilot syllabus.
Mm-hmm. So Mac, let me shift gears here. There's an editorial that you wrote a few months ago about aviation fuels, and the pivot point in your commentary was that it's all about the distribution system. Let me ask you to kind of elaborate on that and talk about where you think the journey to alternative fuels is going to take us, and how fast.
Well, I wish there was a different solution, but it's going to be petroleum-based from petroleum companies, and is going to need to be delivered under the same system as jet fuel is. Avgas exists just on the margins of the jet fuel system. It's just a few percent of the total of aviation fuel. So the same companies and the same FBOs and the same fuel truck makers and everything are going to have to be behind it. And so I think that people making brews in their garage is interesting, and making it from seaweed or whatever, but we really need to be focused on the refiners and the existing suppliers. And of course, whenever I talk to people from like AvFuel, Craig Sincock, or Phillips, who are together make the big majority or sell the big majority of the Avgas, they always remind me that in aviation fuel, the liability is absolute. It's just 100%. If an inferior or contaminated fuel is delivered into someone's tank, that whole chain is liable. And we're only talking about how much money, not who pays. It's going to be the fuel company that pays. So the risks are enormous to anybody who would enter that business, and the startup cost is just unfathomable. So I look to AvFuel, Phillips, the traditional suppliers, for a workable answer, and it's in their interest to make a fuel that's suitable to the biggest majority of users. And so it's not like they're out to screw some group or another. It's totally in their interest, and so. Yeah, I listen the most when the current fuel makers and suppliers talk.
Somewhat of a comparison would be ethanol versus normal unleaded gasoline.
Correct.
It's available, but if you're in the Midwest, it's really available, especially if you drive through Iowa. But it's not necessarily available throughout the country, and depending on the vehicle that you have. For aviation, we've been used to one fuel for a long, long time. Transitioning to several different fuels at once, it may last for a while, but I really think that it's going to be one fuel that we're going to settle on eventually, and we have to kind of think that way.
So, Tom, is the end of 100 low lead the same thing as the search for alternative fuels, or is this not the same thing?
Well, first of all, I think everybody should understand that based on the latest feedback from the EPA and from the FAA, 100 low lead will continue to be available as long as we need 100 low lead to be available. I mean, as long as we can show that we're on a progression and a transition toward an unleaded fuel, we'll have 100 low lead available until that transition is complete. So people shouldn't be concerned about that their engine that they have today is going to become a doorstop in the next few years. That's not going to be the case. So we will have 100 low lead as long as we need it. That's pretty clear. So I think that the trick is really the one fuel thing, as Al said. If we can't achieve that, then we failed, and I think we can achieve that. I disagree a little bit with Mac. I think that while we do need to have the distribution channel come through the way that it does today via the large fuel companies, that's in the current sort of distribution methods. However, I do believe that there are other entities that can be successful in developing the fuel that eventually maybe becomes 100 octane fuel or the Avgas of the future that gets licensed or sold to a major fuel company. I don't think it necessarily has to come out of Bartlesville, Oklahoma, or someplace like that. So I think that there are opportunities for some of the ones that are currently being looked at, Swift and GAMI, interesting programs they're working on. I think it is going to be petroleum-based. I think it's interesting about some kind of a biomass product, but I just don't think that I think that's too big of a transition, that it will be petroleum-based. So, but it'll certainly be an interesting few years as this whole thing unfolds, as the transition plan gets more definition to it. But I think within probably 24 months or so, we're going to have a good sense of what that fuel is, and then there will be a very long transition plan laid out with certain markers along the path that we'll have to hit, so that engine manufacturers and aircraft manufacturers are installing engines that are completely compatible. But I think we'll all have a fuel available for today's engines for a very long time.
Very long, like multiple decades.
Well, I think that the new fuel that gets developed is going to have to be compatible. So I think that I have an IO-550 in my airplane. I'm fully confident that the fuel that we end up with will allow me to continue flying my IO-550 indefinitely.
Okay.
And it's the turbo boosted engines. It's the higher horsepower engines where this is really causing the most problem. The lower horsepower engines, a lot of them can make the transition pretty easily, and some already with a simple STC can burn a different fuel, sometimes MoGas if need be. It's certain parts of the fleet, but the fleet is wide and varied, and it's all used to one fuel, and so that's why it's such a complex issue. We just can't go out and just try to find another fuel. It's a very complex issue because when it hits the fleet, it hits all kinds of different ages of aircraft and ages of parts, and also different missions for those engines.
So in 30 seconds, Tom, if there were one thing that you could fix or have fixed or see to be fixed that would go the furthest in terms of improving our lot in GA, what would that be?
It'd be fixing the pilot population situation. If we could have more pilots coming into the system and being successful and flying more, I think a lot of the issues that general aviation faces would be far less of an issue.
Mac?
I think it'd be a continued improvement in safety. When I talk to my non-pilot friends, and the little subject of little airplanes comes up, that's always topic number one. So anything we can do to improve our safety is going to go a long way in expanding general aviation.
Al?
Similar to what Tom said, the enthusiasm. We have a little bit of enthusiasm gap. We need another wave of enthusiasm from a large group of people about flying.
That's Afterburner Al, or Fareed Gio, who's the, let me get this right, manager of e-publications for EAA Radio, for EAA. Tom Haynes, who's the editor-in-chief of AOPA Journal, and Mac McClellan, who's spent the last 30 years reporting on all things GA. Thank you so much for participating in this year's forum. We hope we'll have the privilege of speaking to you again in future years. This has been the Aviation Journalist Roundtable, and you're listening to EAA Radio.